Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. I really think what you have to do here is chalk one up for financial regulators, because today General Electric said it doesn't want its financial business to be too big to fail anymore. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday. This one is the 10th of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And we will begin today with the once and future story of one of the great companies in the American playbook, General Electric. Founded by Thomas Edison, built on the light bulb, for decades a mainline industrial manufacturer in this country. The thing is that for a long time now, GE hasn't been that. It's been a financial firm among the biggest of the bigs. But today, CEO Jeff Immelt said the company is going back to its roots and will be selling off most of its financial arm, GE Capital, over the next couple of years. First up will be a big chunk of its real estate business. That is going to be offloaded to Blackstone. And then, left standing when all is said and done, will be GE, maker of things. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at why GE is doing what it's doing and what that might tell us about the rest of American finance.
GE's lending business goes way back.
You know what I just love about our GE? Because of the moist, cold refrigeration, you never have to cover dishes.
See your GE dealer about his liberal allowance and credit terms. You'll be glad you did.
Tom O'Boyle is the author of At Any Cost, Jack Welch, General Electric, and the Pursuit of Profit. He says GE's lending arm was a very small part of the business, used mostly to finance the purchase of its products until Jack Welch took the helm in the early 80s.
And Welch grew it from 8% to about 45% in his 20 years. Welch made 1,000 acquisitions, and 800 of them were in finance.
Jack Welch saw bonanza in finance.
Jeff Madrick is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and author of Age of Greed. He says GE realized it could make lots of money in finance with far fewer employees than manufacturing.
And eventually became a full-fledged mortgage lender and a subprime mortgage lender.
We now know where this story is headed. Many companies got into or expanded their financial business. They took too much risk, made too many bad loans. Madrick says now GE's getting out of a business it never fully understood. And in the bigger picture?
Finance is not coming back in a big way. It's okay. It's profitable. The big banks are still here and making loads of money, but the return on investment no longer is there.
It's not that finance is dying, says Jim Wilcox. He's a professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business.
Instead, I would say that the bubbles popped, the damage was done, but now we're going to have a financial sector that is going to be sturdier, and it's going to be sturdier because it'll be the serious, devoted firms that remain in it.
And more regulated ones. GE was labeled a systemically important financial institution a few years ago, meaning more oversight and capital requirements. It doesn't want to be that important anymore, or at least not that kind of important. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
One more quick thought about GE before we get on with things. Part of the big news today was that the company is going to use some or maybe all, I don't know, of the proceeds that it gets from unwinding GE Capital. It's going to be $50 billion to buy back its stock. That ties it with Apple, as it happens, for the biggest share buyback ever in straight dollar terms. Works out, though, to a quite amazing 19% of GE shares outstanding. Traders, as you might imagine, loved them some GE today. That helped send much of the rest of the market higher. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This being a Friday, we're going to take a couple of minutes now to unpack the past 5 days in the global economy. Here to do that with us are Neela Richardson from Redfin, also Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. They are both in our Washington bureau. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi.
So let's see. Sudeep, you get to go first. And the question is, what do you think of my hypothesis that we started with and the bit that Tracy ended with about GE, that regulators may finally have gotten a little bit of purchase here with what they're trying to do?
They have gotten something because they have sent the message that becoming a big, risky financial institution is going to get you more regulation and more attention. And if you don't want to have that designation, then you have to do something about it. So GE here has recognized all the baggage that GE Capital brings to it, and they've decided to go back to making things that are real and that are cool and not just trading a bunch of paper in a way that they didn't necessarily always understand.
So, Neela, do you agree? And do you think we're going to see other firms who are financial in nature but not necessarily with finance as their core business do the same thing?
I think what GE Capital and GE has proven that is there's almost nothing a company won't do to avoid regulation. So, yes, I think we'll see that. And there are a few key non-bank institutions that have been designated SIFI. One of them, MetLife,
is actually systemically important financial institution.
Right. One of them is actually suing the government to get rid of this designation. That tells you how onerous the reporting requirements, the capital requirements are once you get this designation.
So do you suppose, Sudeep, that Barney Frank is sitting back in his retirement in his dotage saying, "I was right"?
A lot of people are sitting back and saying this, and you could have seen this coming from long before we even had the financial crisis, when some of these finance firms were doing what they were doing. The fact that it's taken 6 years from the end of the financial crisis for GE to realize this and move on from where they were before is still a little remarkable, but that is what regulation does.
All right, let us step back to the macro for a second here, Neela, and I want to talk about what appears to be. And I will say at the outset here that stock markets are not the economy and the economy is not the stock market. But here we have the American markets at a high, Shanghai at a high, Hong Kong at a high, Japan's Nikkei is over 20,000. And yet there are some big organizations coming out and saying, wait a minute, the global economy is slowing, the IMF this week. Explain that.
Well, the stock market high, the fear is pumped up by central bank activity. Mm-hmm. And while ours may be slowly coming to a close, it's really just getting started in Europe and in some parts of Asia, where central banks are pursuing these quantitative purchases that will help keep stock markets around the world high. There was a report that just came out not too long ago that only 50% of Americans are invested in the stock market.
And that number
is believed to be on the high side. So there is this disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street.
So what, Sudeep, you're going to say? Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Neela is exactly right. What we're seeing, though, is the stock market is so high because traders have gotten high off of what central banks are doing. And that's what's happening all over the world. And the U.S. in particular is just astonishing that we've had months and months of disappointing economic data, yet markets keep rallying. Because investors are energized by the weak data, because it means that you're going to see continued action from central bankers offsetting the weak profits and the flatlining consumer spending and all the disappointment that we've seen. And this is the power of central banks. They can keep markets afloat for a long time until something comes and whacks them.
But you have to believe, right, Neela, that Janet Yellen is sitting back saying, it's been a decade, you guys, since we've had an interest rate rise. We can't keep them this low.
Absolutely. And, you know, they've been sounding those bells for a long time. But is Wall Street listening to that particular bell?
No.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
They're listening to the bell that they hear every morning, which says it's time to trade. And so that's I think that's what's stoking the high that Sudeep referred to.
Neela Richardson from Redfin and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal out of Washington today. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
All right,
thank you.
Have a good weekend. All right, here is today's number of the day, 500 million. I suppose I should add here and counting, because that is the box office take so far for Furious 7, the seventh in the Fast and Furious film franchise, which means that almost certainly somewhere in Hollywood right now, the phrase Furious 8 is being bandied about. You can be sure Vin Diesel's agent is in on those talks, because Diesel will surely be looking for an even sweeter deal the next time around. But what about his co-stars, Michelle Rodriguez and Ludacris and the rest of the gang? Will they be worth more as well? Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports that when it comes to putting a price on an actor, it's like everything else in Hollywood, performance art.
No matter who you are, when it comes to negotiating your salary, the first thing you have to do is actually negotiate.
I run a business. People want to work for less money, I'll pay them less money. I don't call them up and go, can I give you some more?
That's Amy Pascal, the former studio chief at Sony Pictures, speaking recently at a women's conference in San Francisco. Pascal was fired earlier this year after Sony was hacked, and among other things, its internal emails were all over the internet.
The latest now in the Sony hacking scandal.
Says malicious software infected Sony's computer.
Airing so much dirty laundry from that studio.
Part of the fallout, revelations that the studio was paying some actresses less than their male co-stars.
The truth is that what women have to do is not work for less money. They have to walk away. People shouldn't be so grateful for jobs. People should know what they're worth and say no.
Easy to do if, say, you're Sandra Bullock or Angelina Jolie, who get $20 million a picture. But they are big-name exceptions who can call the shots. For most actors, the salary calculation is made by someone else. And the formula is changing.
It's a calculus you go through on each film.
Peter Seely runs a marketing firm and is the former head of marketing at Columbia Pictures.
And it involves a lot of variables, but principally it is, how much of a draw would that actor or actress be for your target audience?
Okay, yes, you've got to get people into the seats, preferably on opening weekend. Then there's how much the movie itself costs and what it's supposed to accomplish.
Is it a tentpole film where it's important to the studio's long-term health? If those factors are in play, the price of the actor goes up.
A tentpole, say a big-budget James Bond movie, is supposed to make so much money that it covers the bombs the studio makes and boosts the bottom line. The last Bond movie cost a reported $200 million, $17 million of which went to Daniel Craig. That payout probably also had something to do with the fact that Craig had been Bond before.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
And if you're trying to get somebody to repeat a past success, obviously you wind up paying them more.
Mike Medavoy headed up Orion and TriStar Pictures in the 80s and 90s. He's now a film producer. He says today, it's all about the brand.
Liam Neeson is a perfect example of that.
I can tell you I don't have money, but what I do have are a very particular set of skills.
Oh, yes. Neeson reportedly went from $1 million for that first Taken film to $20 million for Taken 3. That movie made hundreds of millions, most of it overseas. Which brings us to another factor in the salary equation, how well an actor travels.
You know, at this point, about 65 to 70% of the revenue comes out of foreign and not out of the domestic market.
Revenue also comes from video, internet, television. Even an actor's social media profile may be worth something, says entertainment lawyer Jonathan Handel. Although the power of 5 million Twitter followers is still being worked out.
That's something that talent representatives can use in arguing for a given salary. Exactly how that translates into dollars, you know, is a bit of a dark art.
And Handel says nothing is playing a bigger role in actor salaries these days than the shrinking movie business. Studios are making fewer films, and they're relying more than ever on special effects and comic book characters to carry their big franchises.
You know, if you're casting a Spider-Man movie, it's mostly about Spider-Man and not about the particular actor.
Compare that to the 1990s when movie budgets ballooned and actors' salaries went up and up, Handel says.
The power that actors and their representatives used to have has diminished.
And that's meant smaller salaries for all but the biggest of the big-name actors. Most others, Handel says, are not in a position to say no, as former Sony exec Amy Pascal suggested. They are instead taking the deal. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Coming up, basketball Philadelphia style.
The plan that the Sixers are attempting has never been tried before. It may be a very clever plan, or it may be too clever a plan.
Or just not clever at all. Remains to be seen. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 98 points today, 0.5%, closed at 18,057. The NASDAQ gained 21 points, 0.4%, 49.95. The S&P 500 added 10 points, 0.5%, ended at 2102. For the week gone by, the Dow up 1.6%, The NASDAQ up 2.2%, the S&P 500 up 1.7%. Investors did indeed like General Electric's commitment to make things you can actually touch. GE up more than 10% today. Fidelity National Information Services, which supports the back office functions of a lot of banks, lowered its earnings guidance and thus its shares lost 3.75%. Heartland Payment Systems, which provides credit card processing, went the other way, up about 0.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, Congress returns from recess. The World Watch Institute releases its annual State of the World report, focusing on the environment. And on April 13, 1964, Sidney Poitier became the first black Oscar winner for Best Actor in a Leading Role. The picture? Lilies of the Field. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you have waited this long, I'm sorry to tell you, it's too late. Apple sold out of its watches in less than 6 hours this morning, so you can push back your delivery date to May or even June. I know, terrible. But that said, it's going to be interesting to see what happens when this thing finally hits the market, because all of those apps that we're used to using phone-sized are going to have to be downsized. Very tiny apps built for a very tiny screen. Marketplace's David Weinberg talked to some people about how exactly you do that.
Beth Dean wears a Fitbit Surge, a smartwatch that monitors her health. And one day, she accidentally changed the settings on it, and the next time she got a text, her wrist vibrated, and she literally screamed in horror.
I was not expecting that experience. I would say that it felt pretty invasive.
Dean is a product designer at Facebook, and she says that designing for this new platform, a smartwatch, means not only thinking about how things will look on a very tiny screen, but also designing for a device that you can't escape from. It's physically shackled to your body.
Yeah, I think like good design is going to respect any sort of notification preferences.
Imagine if someone tapped you on the wrist several times a minute, all day, every day.
Hey, would you like to join the wireless network, Party Boy Forever? Hey, your ex in her heartbeat. Hey, 23 people liked your photo of your breakfast. Hey, you got an email from your bank. You've got $5.
Maybe each smartwatch would have to come with a smart straitjacket, because this could drive you mad. But these types of notifications are really the essence of what smartwatches will do.
You can't really do a lot of really complex and interactive applications. It's more about consuming things at a glance.
Designer Matt Knutson says designing for a watch means reducing the complexity of the app by orders of magnitude, in the same way web applications are adapted for mobile phones.
If you have a product that starts on the web, the challenge there is to figure out what pieces translate well to mobile.
And similarly, with a smartwatch, it's not about taking an entire app and squeezing it onto a watch. The idea is to figure out which pieces of that app make sense in the much smaller, simpler platform attached to your wrist. In this case, pieces that deliver little bits of information that hopefully don't make you scream or drive you mad. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Chalk went up for the movement afoot in parts of the country to cut back on standardized testing in schools. The Florida legislature has passed a bill limiting how much time students can spend on state testing to no more than 45 hours a year. That's 45 hours spent with number two pencil in hand actually taking the test. It doesn't count all the hours spent prepping for the tests. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
A few years back, the Foundation for Excellence in Education looked into how many standardized tests students were taking in Florida.
Some school districts were requiring as few as 8 tests on top of what the state required, and some districts were requiring up to 200 additional tests.
I'm exhausted just hearing that from Patricia Levesque, CEO of the foundation. And she's an advocate of using tests to measure kids' progress and hold schools accountable. Her group was founded by former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who expanded testing in the state. But even the foundation supported the bill passed this week.
There is such a thing as too many tests.
In addition to capping the number of hours students spend taking tests, the bill would eliminate an 11th grade English test, and schools would no longer have to give final exams in every subject not covered by state tests. Bob Schaefer with the national group Fair Test says that's progress, but not enough.
The vast amount of time devoted to testing in public schools is not administering the exams themselves, but the huge amounts of time spent by teachers and students getting ready for the test.
Around the country, more families are refusing to let their kids take the tests. Cindy Hamilton co-founded the group Opt Out Orlando. She says the Florida bill doesn't fix her main concern, that poor test scores can be used to hold kids back.
The bill falls very short of what we're looking for. The opt-out movement isn't going anywhere.
If anything, Hamilton expects it to grow. This year, Florida students are taking new, more difficult tests tied to the Common Core standards, and many more students are expected to fail. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The Philadelphia 76ers are one of the marquee franchises of the National Basketball Association. They have won three championships. They've had some of the league's all-time greats wear the uniform. This year, however, they are just terrible. 18 wins, 61 losses, right at the bottom of the league in home attendance as well. And yes, every team does go through years when they are rebuilding, but not every team trades out its veteran players for younger prospects and higher draft picks, banking on a very, very uncertain future. Michael Sokolov writes about the hapless Sixers for the New York Times Magazine this weekend and why they might be doing what they're doing. Michael, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
You say very unkind things about the Philadelphia 76ers in this article, man. Very unkind. The least capable assemblage of basketball players ever? Well, I mean, come on.
Well, I said some kind things,
well,
too.
That's
but
true.
Yes, I did say that. And they are a lovable group, but they are entirely overmatched when they go out there against a good NBA team or even a decent NBA team playing hard, they have very little chance to win.
They are owned by a group of New York financiers who bought the team, what, 3-4 years ago. The general manager is a Stanford MBA who's a sports analytics guy, right?
That is correct.
And they are now just, I mean, they're playing the odds, basically. They're saying, listen, we're gonna churn through this, find as many good young players as we can and keep them and then throw the rest away.
Well, they're playing the odds, but the interesting thing is that the odds have never been played in this way. You know, there have been teams in the NBA that weren't great teams, and they built steadily, and they became good teams. The plan that the Sixers are attempting has never been tried before, and it may be a very clever plan, or it may be too clever a plan.
I would go with a different word, actually. I would call it deeply, deeply cynical.
I think it is deeply cynical.
Do you think that this team is actually in tank mode? That is to say, and this is a tough accusation to make, right? Consciously losing games as a way to, in the long run, better their chances.
Well, it depends what you consider tank mode. The players surely are not tanking. They're trying very hard. Management is certainly tanking. There's not a move that they have made last year or this year that has had the intent of giving them a better chance to win the next game.
This whole article reminded me of Moneyball, the book by Michael Lewis about the Oakland A's and Billy Beane, who did a similar thing sort of with the Oakland A's 10 or 12 years ago.
You know, Kai, I think a lot of people would see it that way. But if you remember right. Moneyball, you know, Billy Beane is pacing and he's going crazy. He's living and dying with each game, game's result. He's trying to win, and he's trying to win soon.
You couldn't get the ownership of this team to go on the record with what the heck they're up to, but you did get him to talk about sort of a philosophy, right?
I think we can intuit the philosophy is, you know, we've got a better plan. The rest of y'all out there trying to win right now and trying to win gradually and trying to do it in some traditional sense, look at us. We've got a plan that's going to work. Just wait and see. But if there's such a thing as sports ethics, and maybe that's questionable in and of itself, but if there's such a thing as that, you know, I think this really pushes the line of what's ethical, because I think you're supposed to go out there and try to win. And they're clearly not in that mode.
It's interesting to contrast that, then, the ownership's mentality with the players' mentality. You spend a good amount of time with the players. The closing scene is actually a practice, which is rare in the NBA during the season because they travel so much. But it's a practice in which enthusiasm, you write, was really high.
Well, Kai, I absolutely love the players because no more than 2 or 3 of them have an assured NBA career.
Wow.
And the rest of them are out there
auditioning and getting court time, which they could not get with any other team in the NBA. So these guys are desperate. They're diving on the floor for loose balls. If they have a bad shooting night, they're in the gym that night past midnight practicing their shots. So you want to root for these guys. You want them to have what they want.
Well, you ask one of these kids, right, because they're all really young. You ask one of them, what's the best part about being in the NBA? And the guy says, best part about being in the NBA is being in the NBA, man.
Yes, he looked at me like I was an utter fool for asking that question.
Mike Sokolov, his article in the New York Times Magazine this weekend, it's online now, we should say, is called How Low Can the Philadelphia 76ers Go? And the answer, by the way, is pretty low. Mike, thanks very much.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that 21-year-old American Jordan Spieth is tearing it up at the Masters. He set a 36-hole record today, a 14-under par 130 for the first 2 days. Augusta National, the home of the Masters, certainly has its issues, but gouging spectators at the concession stands apparently is not one of them. A CBS Sports producer took $100 with him out on the course the other day to see how many golf fans he could buy lunch for at the tournament. $100 fed 17 people at Augusta National is the answer, in part because pimento cheese sandwiches, whatever they are, can be had for $1.50. Soda pop, Coca-Cola, and the rest, they're just the same. Seriously, pimento cheese? What is it? Is it just cheese with pimentos in it? It's almost too easy, right? All right, the Dow up 98 points today, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 21 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 added 10 points, 0.5%. How do you suppose it tastes, by the way? Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Tommy Andres is the acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. You know who I am, but this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.